Okay, I guess we can get underway. Today's lecture, we're going to finish up, hopefully, our discussion on matrices and their inverses. And then that's the end of the material that's going to be covered on the first exam. However, I don't want to have the first exam immediately because there's a problem set, actually two problem sets 4 and 5, that are due on Monday. And so I want to postpone the first exam. The earliest possible date would be Wednesday of next week, so we can go over the problem sets. But I actually think it'd be better to be Friday, so that if there are any difficulties on the problem set, we can address those on Monday, and then we could do a more general review, a full review on Wednesday, and then do the exam on Friday. So let me pull a class if there, because of maybe other exams or other things. Actually, I can postpone that decision until Friday, so you can look at your schedules first. But I would think that the likely time for the exam is going to be a week from this Friday. But this Friday, I may ask you if you would be willing to have the exam as early as Wednesday, which you might do if you have two other exams next Friday. I don't want to push the exam off any further to the following week, because we'll have essentially a bunch of material that we'll start to cover, and you'll forget about this material on, the calculational material we've developed so far. So in fact, the course kind of makes a shift after the first exam as we start to do less emphasis on calculation, but more emphasis on tying things together in a theoretical fashion. And so, yeah, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself with the new material before we've actually had a test on material up to this point. So let me just see a show of hands if there are any strenuous objections to next a week from Friday for having the exam. Nothing. Okay, so I'm going to pull my other class as well, because I'm going to give the I have two sections, and I want to give the exam on the same day. So I'll pull them as well, but I suspect that it's going to be a week from Friday that we do our first exam. Now, a week from today, we'll do a full review session to prepare you for the exam. And then Monday next week, kind of working backwards, Monday next week, homework sets will be due. If there are any issues on those problem sets, particularly the row reduction, we can try to address those in class as well. Okay, so questions so far? Yeah, people generally don't have questions at the beginning of class, but interrupt me if you have questions during class. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to quickly review the material that we covered in Monday's lecture on matrix inverses. Then we're going to do a relatively hard calculation of matrix inverse. So that calculation is going to involve row reduction, and I'm doing a strenuous row reduction problem just to show you that it can be done even if things don't work out nicely. And then what I'm going to end today's lecture it's called the fundamental theorem, because what it's going to do, it's going to tie together lots of concepts that we've developed. And you see that, yes, even though we have one calculation or another calculation, that somehow these things are all related to one another. And that's actually going to be, at least thematically, the sort of discussion that we're going to have in detail following the first exam, as we now begin to see how these linear algebraic constructs work together. Okay, so let me get started. This should work. Yeah, good. So by a matrix inverse, it's the analog of a multiplicative inverse for numbers. It's for numbers, you say 1/2 is the multiplicative inverse of 2, because 1/2 times 2 equals 1, which is the identity element with respect to multiplication. Well, for matrices, we have a similar idea. We actually have two conditions, because for matrix multiplication, B times A is not necessarily equal to A times B. The order of multiplication makes a difference. However, For this question of whether or not we can multiply a matrix times another and produce the identity matrix, it turns out that these two conditions are equivalent to one another. If B times A is going to equal the identity matrix, it's also going to be true that A times B is equal to the identity matrix, but that's kind of hard to prove, so I won't even attempt it in this course. Effectively, though, if you simply have B times A is equal to the identity matrix, you're going to know that B is actually the inverse of A. So, and that's the first theorem we showed, that if you do have a square matrix and it has an inverse, there's only one possibility for it. And so the rest of Monday's lecture was devoted to figuring out, well, how do we actually find the inverse of a given matrix? So then we're using this notation, A superscript minus one, to indicate the inverse, the unique inverse of a matrix. Okay, so what we developed last time was an algorithm for calculating that inverse, but let me remind you of the sort of theoretical material that went into the calculation of A to minus first. First of all, we have the fact that the inverse, if it does exist, it's a unique matrix. And so basically the problem of finding A to minus first is finding some matrix times A that produces the identity matrix. If you have this multiplicative identity, then you know automatically that C is your guy. That's the guy you want. All right, so then the problem came, well, how do we find such a matrix C? And for that, I introduce a theoretical tool, not a practical tool for doing calculations, but it's on this slide, you'll see the utility of these elementary matrices. The idea of an elementary matrix, well, is you have these row operations that you can perform on any matrix. And in particular, you can perform them on the identity matrix. When you take an identity matrix and you do an elementary row operation on it, you create a new matrix. We call that the elementary matrix corresponding to the given row operation. Now, what's nice about these is the elementary matrices give us an alternative way of implementing row reduction. So here, on the left-hand side, I'm meaning you have some elementary row operation, interchanging rows, scalar multiplying a row, replacing a row by its sum with a multiple of another row, some elementary row operation. Now, you can either do that directly to the matrix, or you can construct this elementary matrix by doing that same operation to the identity matrix and then doing matrix multiplication rather than operating directly on the matrix itself. Doing it this way is going to take longer, right? Because you have to do the row operation to one matrix, and then you have to do matrix multiplication. But the point is that here we can implement that row operation using a matrix multiplication. And in fact, what we're looking for is something that when you multiply A by a matrix, you get the identity. We're looking for a matrices that will convert A to the identity matrix. And we know that using row operations, we can convert matrices to other matrices. So the thing we might try to do is row reduce a matrix to the identity matrix. So that would look something like this. I have a sequence of elementary row operations that systematically transform my given matrix to its reduced row echelon form, which we're supposing is going to be the identity matrix. Well, because of the existence of these elementary matrices, this sequence of elementary row operations could be done by, instead of operating directly on the matrix, operating on the identity matrix to get these elementary matrices, and then just carrying out this matrix multiplication. But if you look at this equation here, I is equal to this product of matrices times A. This product of matrices has to be the inverse of A because this product, considered as a single matrix, times A produces the identity matrix. So we're satisfying that equation, and that's going to make that left-hand factor, we'll be able to identify it as A the minus first. And so that's the idea that's underlying the following calculations. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to figure out what this matrix is by calculating it directly. And it turns out, as you'll see on the next slide, is you do not have to individually calculate these individual factors. What we'll be able to do is do a single row reduction, and then this product is going to be automatically formed at the end. So the way that's done is we don't operate on just A itself. Rather, we operate elementary row operations on A adjoined with the identity matrix. Now, what's going to happen is that we're going to try to put this matrix, the original matrix we started off with, and the identity matrix of the same size, we put them right next to another, make a matrix with double the columns, the same number of rows as the original matrix. Then we'll calculate its reduced row echelon form. Well, we know how to do that. You get rid of pivots below pivots until you reach row echelon form, and then you rescale pivots and clear out entries above pivots to get it in reduced row echelon form. That can be done to any matrix, including this augmented matrix. And what will happen then is that when you are able to row reduce a matrix A to the identity matrix, this double matrix ends up getting row reduced to the identity matrix, and then something else is going to happen to this right-hand factor. And in fact, that right-hand factor is going to be exactly the inverse of A. So what I'm saying here is you start off with a coefficient matrix A and adjoined it with I, and then you start applying row operations to it. And you don't have to convert these guys to elementary matrices at all. You just have to row reduce until you reach reduced row echelon form. And then one of two things is going to happen. If the reduced row echelon form of the factor on the, well, not a factor, but the left-hand side of this augmented matrix, if that gets row reduced to the identity matrix, then what happens to the right-hand side under the same sequence of row operations? It's going to be exactly ERK R1, the same sequence of elementary row operations. And then in fact, this is just A the minus first. Or you get something else. On the left, that is either this left-hand side row reduces to the identity matrix or it doesn't. If it does, then whatever happened to the right-hand side, that's going to be identifiable as the inverse of your matrix. And on the other hand, if A is not row reducible to the identity matrix, then you're going into this situation, and that means there's no inverse. Okay, so that's the calculation of the inverse of a matrix. What it boils down to is the row reduction of a single matrix. You have to double the number of columns, you get A and A, but you just row reduce this matrix, see what pops out. If you end up in this situation where the reduced row echelon form of this matrix has the identity matrix on the left-hand side, then you know that whatever happened to the right-hand side, that's exactly what your inverse is. Otherwise, A is not going to have an inverse. Okay, so in the end, it just boils down to this row reduction calculation. All right, so let's do a row reduction calculation. We use row reduction to solve linear systems. And now what we're going to do is use row reduction to figure out the inverse of a matrix. So here's a 3x3 matrix. It's a square matrix because matrix inverses only exist when you have the same number of rows as you have columns. So 3x3, that's good. First thing we'll do is we'll take the given matrix and we'll adjoin to it the identity matrix at the same size. All right, and now what we're going to do is we're going to take this matrix. This line is kind of imaginary. It's just helping us separate this double matrix into its constituent parts. What we'll do is we'll start row reducing this matrix. So what do we got to do first? Well, we got to pivot up in this upper left-hand column. But we have this pivot sitting below it as well. So we got to get rid of it. Now, this example's going to be a little bit more strenuous because unlike most of the examples I've done before, this pivot is 2 rather than 1. So if I'm going to clear out this entry, I not only have to multiply the first row by -3, but I'm also going to have to divide it by 2 so that you actually get that cancellation. So in fact, what you have to do, and sometimes unavoidable, sometimes you do have to introduce fractions into this row reduction calculation. All right, so let's do that. If we replace the second row by its sum with -3/2 times the first row, that 2 in the denominator is going to cancel that, and the 3 in the numerator coming in with a negative sign is going to what allows us to cancel that guy. And so what we get, move this up a little bit, what we get is a new matrix. Now, look all the way across this matrix to figure out where the pivots are. They're all going to occur on this side. And so we've got it in row echelon form, at least up to the second row. But this third row, we have a pivot below a pivot, so we're going to have to clear out this guy. So maybe the next step, if I can display this, maybe the next step, and of course you have choices. The way you actually row reduce to reduce to echelon form, there's many, many different paths to that final result. So I could do a couple things at this point. I could maybe multiply the second row by 2 to make it simpler to add to the row. And anyway, I'm going to want that pivot to equal 1 eventually anyway. I could also multiply the first row by 1/2 to get that pivot equal to 1. But actually, I'm going to delay working with this guy until the very end. My primary concern initially is to get it into row echelon form, not reduce row echelon form. So I'm going to multiply the second row by 2 simply to get this pivot equal to 1. So it's a little bit easier to work with. So I corrected this second row. And now you see it's very easy to cancel this guy with effectively 2 times the original second row. And so what we'll do is we'll simply replace the third row by its sum with the second row. And that will produce a matrix that now, at least in row echelon form, because the pivots are occurring in the proper downward staircase. Pivots are sort of start in the upper left-hand corner, and they systematically, as you drop down, the pivots move off to the right. Okay, now that's halfway through. Yeah.
It's not.
No, that's reduced row echelon form. So yeah, there are more conditions we're going to impose, but once you reach this stage, your strategy changes. That's why I've separated the two. Yeah, eventually we're going to have to make that guy 1, and this guy also has to be made 1, but we're also going to have to clear out the entries above the pivots. But the reason why I stop here is because what happens when you reach row echelon form is the position of the pivots, not their values, but the position of the pivots inside the matrix, it's not going to change any further. You're always going to have a pivot in the first row, in the first column, always will have a pivot, no matter what you do, working towards reduced row echelon form, the position of the pivots inside that matrix is not going to change anymore. What you do is you fix them up by making them sure they're all equal to 1, and you clear out entries above them, but the position of the pivots doesn't change. That, by the way, allows you to see already at this early stage, if we were solving linear equations, how many solutions there would be. Because if you look forward to the end of the calculation, where you write down the solution as a hyperplane, The columns that do not have pivots correspond to free parameters. But you can see where the pivots are going to be already at this stage. And for this matrix, they're going to be here, here, and here. There are no columns without pivots, and so there's going to be a unique solution if I were solving a linear system. But in fact, what we're trying to do here is find the inverse of the matrix. So I'm just pointing out some nuances of row reduction that really aren't applicable. Well, they're kind of meaningless in the current context of finding the inverse of a matrix. But if we were solving a linear system, which looks more like this, then we would be able to count the number of free parameters in the solution as soon as we reach row echelon form. We don't have to go all the way to reduce row echelon form to see the nature of the solution. Okay, so let's continue. We're not at reduced row echelon form yet. We're essentially halfway through that process. So the next step is to maybe fix this pivot. I'm going to multiply it by -1. And now at least the first two, the last two rows have pivots equal to 1. Now, I still have this guy here. I'm going to worry about him at the very end. So the first thing I'm going to do, next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of this entry that's sitting above a pivot in the lower row. So I add 2 times the third row to the second row and use that as the replacement for the second row. You get this. Good. Starting to look a little cleaner now, but we have an entry here as well. Again, I'll use this bottom row, its pivot, to clear out the entry above it. And so to get rid of that guy, I subtract 4 times the third row from the first row to clear out that entry. And then finally, to get the entries above and below pivots all equal to 0, I need to clear out this entry. And so that's just going to involve subtracting from row 1 the second row. And you end up with this matrix. And now, finally, we'll do something about this too. I delayed it because I didn't want to introduce fractions, and that by delaying fixing this until the very end, I can now divide the whole row by 2 without introducing any fractions. And so what you get in the end is this matrix on the right-hand side or the left-hand side, which is the identity matrix. According to this rule here, the row reduction of our original matrix produced the identity matrix on the left and some other matrix on the right. Well, this guy, the 753, 3 minus 2 minus 2, 3 minus 2 minus 1, that matrix is going to be exactly the inverse of A. And the calculation is done. So this row reduction calculation that was useful for solving linear systems, you now see it has another application. It helps us find the inverse of a matrix. Okay, yeah. You're probably right. I got a typo there. Yeah. So I'll try to remember that in my. I'll try to correct the online notes when I get back to my office. Yeah, that should have been -7. Okay. Yeah, it was pretty clear. All right. So there's a calculation of inverse of a matrix. If you know row reduction, it's not hard at all. It's straightforward, maybe strenuous, but it's straightforward to actually find its inverse. And that's going to be what's going on in homework set 5. But you should already be pretty familiar with row reduction once you've done problem set 4. Okay, so now we come to sort of a strange departure from what I've been emphasizing up to this point. What I've been emphasizing up to this point in the course is how to do calculations, how to solve linear systems, how to row reduce matrices, how to do scalar multiplication, how to multiply matrices together. What's going to happen next is we're going to transition over into a broader understanding as what's going on, because these various calculations are linked to one another. So I'm going to give you a theorem that applies to any square matrix. And what it's going to do is going to relate the problem of finding solutions to a linear system where A is a coefficient matrix to the problem of finding its inverse, to the problem of row reducing it to the identity matrix, et cetera. So here's a statement. I'm going to list five statements that you're going to have the property that if you can verify any one of them, then you'll know that the other four statements are true. So the first one is that this square matrix actually does have an inverse. So calculation-wise, that's going to mean that if I take my matrix and I join it with the identity matrix, I'm guaranteed that it's going to, the left-hand side is going to row reduce to the identity matrix. The existence of this inverse, though, is actually a necessary and sufficient condition to be able to solve any linear system where A appears as the coefficient matrix. And in fact, it's going to be a solution that's actually unique. It's not going to be a more elaborate hyperplane that, other than a single point. Here's a third condition, which looks like a special case of the second one. So here, B is some vector that I put on the right-hand side of a linear system. However, if I choose B equal to zero, I get a stronger statement. Here, I only want to know about the existence of a unique solution. So it's kind of a weak requirement. C is stronger. If you actually replace B by the zero vector, then in fact, there's only the only solution is X is equal to the zero vector. And then a fourth condition is that when I row reduce A to its reduced row echelon form, that has to be the identity matrix. And then finally, a fifth property is that A itself can be factorized, and it's going to be a product of elementary matrices. So this is sort of like analogous to being able to take an arbitrary integer and write it as a product of primes. This statement here is similar. If you have a matrix A that for which the inverse exists, for example, then you'll know that it has to be factorizable as a product of those elementary matrices that we create by applying row operations to the identity matrix. And so we're actually able to factorize a matrix. All right, so what I'm going to do to prove that theorem is I'm going to show that the first statement implies the second implies the third implies fourth implies the fifth, and then the fifth takes me back to the start. So in fact, if any one of these statements true, you just by following this chain of implications, if C is true, then D is true, then E is true, then A is true, then A is true, and B is also true. So you just, it's a closed circle of implications. And so that's generally how you prove the equivalence of statements. You show that it's a closed chain. All right, so let's do that. I didn't write these statements down, but as I go through the proofs, I'll restate these two conditions. Now, as I remarked very on in the course, this is not a proof course. So I'm not going through these proofs just so that you can memorize them and then apply them on the exam. You will not see this proof on the exam. However, I do want to go through this step by step to show you the logic of what's going on, because at its most fundamental level, this theorem is about connecting the logic that we've already developed. So let's do this first one. I'm going to show that statement A was that A has an inverse, and statement B was that a linear system where I use A as a coefficient matrix always has a unique solution. All right. So I'm going to show this. First, I'm going to suppose that A is invertible, and that means it has an inverse that I'll denote by A the minus first. What I claim is, first of all, that I have a solution to such a system. So So what I'm going to do is I'm going to substitute into this equation a to minus first d, and I'll verify that the equation holds. So here's ax. I'll substitute for this value of x, and I'll try to show that the right-hand side eventually evaluates to just b. So here it goes. You just regroup those multiplicative factors. A times a to the minus first is equal to the identity matrix. The identity matrix times any other matrix is equal to that second matrix. And so there you go. Here I've explicitly displayed a to the minus first b as the solution of this equation. All right, so I haven't quite proved the statement here. All I've shown is that I do have a solution, and here it is. What remains to complete this statement is to show you that it's unique. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll suppose that we have another solution of this equation. All right, so if y is the solution, it satisfies the same equation. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to multiply both sides of this equation by the inverse of a, which we are supposing exists. Then a to the minus first times, here I'm just multiplying both sides from the left by a to the minus first. Then the left-hand side is going to simplify to the identity matrix and times y, and then I times y is just y. And now you see that if y is a solution, and I simply multiply the equation it satisfies by a to the minus first, it tells me that y is equal to a to the minus first b. Well, that's not a new solution. That's the same solution that we already discovered. And so if we have any other solution, it had to be the one that we originally found, and so we're done. We found the unique solution. Okay, so that's how the logic works, and we're done with the first step of this five-statement theorem, which showed that the first statement implies the second. Okay, so now next thing in the chain would be that the second statement implies the third. The second statement was that a linear system AX equals B has a unique solution. So we'll assume that, and then what I want to conclude is that the only solution of this linear system where the right-hand side is equal to zero, that the only solution of that is X is equal to zero. Well, this is really easy. First of all, we're supposing that we only have one solution no matter how we choose B. So if I choose B equal to zero, I'm still only going to have one solution. It's a special case of condition B. But on the other hand, if I simply substitute X, the zero vector for X in this equation, it's an identity, right? Because any matrix times the zero vector is going to produce the zero vector. So what do I know? I know I have a unique solution of this equation, and I've found the solution. So the unique solution is that zero vector. All right, so that handles that chain, that link in the chain. All right, so now we'll start with a third statement, that X equaling the zero vector is the only solution of this equation. And what I'm going to want to now conclude is that the coefficient matrix A has to be row reducible to the identity matrix. How do we do that? Well, remember the way we find solutions of linear systems is we use row reduction. And what I'm saying here is that X equals zero is the solution. Well, what's the stage just before we write down the solution of a linear system? Well, we have this augmented matrix. It's somehow we did elementary row operations until we reached reducible echelon form, and we get to this augmented matrix of the solution. And so here it is. If you look at the equations corresponding to this augmented matrix, it's exactly the statement that X is equal to the zero vector. Here we have 1 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3, et cetera, is equal to 0. Second row is saying x2 has to equal 0. Last row is saying the nth variable xn is equal to 0. So I'm replicating this solution with this augmented matrix. Well, okay, so stepping back from the solution to its augmented matrix, well, we know this augmented matrix had to come from row reduction, the original matrix. And so what we know, since this is the form of the augmented matrix of the solution, I can only reach that by applying elementary row operations, and so that my coefficient matrix was converted into the identity matrix. And so if x equals 0 is the only solution to this equation, then the coefficient matrix has to reduce, be row reducible to this left-hand side, which is exactly the identity matrix. Okay, good. So I think we're done with that. I'm just repeating that argument that because that augmented matrix was obtained by row reducing this matrix to its reducial echelon form, we can conclude that, in fact, A itself had to be row reducible to that identity matrix. All right, now we're up to the fourth statement. Here, I'm now going to assume that there's a way of row reducing A to the identity matrix. And what I'm to show is that A itself is a product of elementary matrices. Well, this is going to replicate much of the argument I gave at the start of class. If I have a sequence of row operations that systematically converts A to the identity matrix, I can implement those row operations via the corresponding elementary matrices. Instead of acting directly on a matrix, I could do that row operation to the identity matrix to compute this elementary matrix factor, and then do matrix multiplication to have the same effect as R1 acting on A. And this is the elementary matrix corresponding to R1 multiplying A from the left. But this sequence of elementary row operations can be implemented instead by a product of elementary matrices. All right, now what this shows you is that, in fact, what's written here is actually A the minus first, right? Because this product of matrices times A produces the identity matrix. That product has to be A the minus first. What I've arguing thus far is that not A itself, but rather the inverse of A is a product of elementary matrices. The way I get the stronger statement that A itself is also a product of elementary matrices, well, that argument has two steps to it. First of all, the first thing you do is you show that every elementary matrix has an inverse. And they're easy to figure out what those inverses are, because we understand those elementary operations, it's being tied to particular row operations. And so let me do an example here. Suppose I have an elementary operation that switches two rows. Well, so that's going to be a corresponding, row I interchanging with row J. Okay, so the corresponding elementary matrix, you would switch the I and jth row of the identity matrix to get this elementary matrix. Multiplying the I's elementary matrix, all it does is switch rows. And what I'm trying to say here is that the inverse of this guy is exactly going to be itself. So if the elementary row operation corresponding to interchanging these two rows, because if I interchange two rows and I do that operation again, I get back to where I started with. And so effectively, the inverse of this elementary matrix is exactly itself. And if you had an operation that, say, sends row I to its sum with a multiple of another row, What's going to happen in this case is if I create the corresponding elementary matrix, so let me write it this way. Ri goes to Ri plus lambda Rj. Take that particular elementary row operation, I calculate its elementary matrix, and then I compute its inverse. Well, what this is going to be, it's going to be another elementary matrix that undoes this operation. And effectively, what it's going to be is the ith row is going to be replaced by Ri minus lambda Rj. So here what I did is I changed the ith row by adding something to it. To undo that, what I do is I subtract it off again. But this is just another elementary row operation, right? It's just where the parameter lambda has switched signs, but it's still the sum of Ri with a multiple of another row. So in fact, what happens here is that each of these elementary matrices, their inverses are going to be other elementary matrices. So what you do then, if A the minus first is equal to ERK, ER1, so this product of elementary matrices, so you reduce A to, now reduce to echelon form, you get the identity matrix. That means that this product of elementary matrices is exactly the inverse of A. If I take the inverse of both sides of that equation, A to the minus first to the minus first is going to equal A. And what's going to happen on the right? Well, when I introduce inverses of matrices on Monday, I said that you can calculate the, if you know a product of matrices, you can calculate the inverse of that matrix by, first of all, writing it as a product, and then to get the inverse, you take the inverses of the original factors, but you reverse the order. So this is going to be R1 to the minus first. Second factor would be ER2 to the minus first. And first factor is going to be ERK to the minus first. What I'm using here is the rule that AB to the minus first is equal to B to the minus first, A to the minus first. But if I have more factors, the generalization is simple. When you take the inverse of a product of matrices, you get a product of the inverses, but the order of the factors is reversed. And so what I did, from this equation, I see how I can write A to the minus first as a product of elementary matrices. Then I take the inverse of both sides of this equation. A to the minus first to the minus first is exactly equal to A. And then it's now expressed by converting each of these factors into their inverses and reversing the order of the product, I get the inverse. And then finally, what I'm using is the observation that when you undo an elementary operation, you get another elementary operation. And so even though these guys are stated as the inverses of elementary matrices, they're also elementary matrices themselves. And we're done. We've argued that, This essentially we showed on Monday's lecture, and then here we're applying it. Once we write A is A to the minus first to first, we take the inverse of this product, and then we get a product of the inverses written in the reverse order. But since each of these inverses of an elementary matrix is another elementary matrix, we've got our matrix A displayed as a product of elementary matrices. Okay, so now we have to close the loop. So the loop is closed when we can show that if A is a product of elementary matrices, that it's necessarily invertible. And so here it is, but each of these elementary matrices is invertible. And so A is written as a product of elementary matrices. And now we do that same calculation. We take the multiplicative inverse of both sides of that equation, and that displays that here's a formula for the inverse of A. If it's row reducible to the identity matrix, well, if it's a product of elementary matrices, then we can calculate its inverse by simply using that product rule for calculating inverses. Okay, and so now I've gone full circle. All right, now what's going to happen before the midterm, because my intention on Friday is to move forward with material, but that will not be covered on the first exam. But what we're going to start to do on Friday is start to utilize these chains of implications to extract more information and see sort of higher level connections from the things we've been calculating all along. All right, so I'll stop here, pause for questions if there are any. Yeah. Well, so I think it's very, very likely that the exam is going to be a week from this Friday. However, I'm giving everyone an opportunity to look at their own schedules, and we'll discuss it again on Friday if that's a reasonable date. Okay, other questions? Okay, good. Then I'll see you on Friday. Please have a look at the homework problems, at least in homework set 4, so we can identify any problems you might run into in row reduction.
Hi. What's Gauss elimination?
What's the what?
Gauss elimination.
Oh, the row reduction process.
Okay.
So it was invented by Gauss.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes it's called Gauss-Jordan reduction.
Gauss,
yeah.
And then Gauss-Jordan.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I think maybe Gauss is just getting to row echelon form, and Gauss-Jordan is going all the way to reduced row echelon form. They should be done by next Monday. That'd be, but you'll have in fact until the end of the semester to turn them in.
Yeah. It was like in May, and
yeah.
Was like,
yeah.
Or